Welcome to the Leadership Window Podcast with Patrick Jinks. Each week, through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and professional speaker. And now, here's Patrick.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 19 of the Leadership Window. I am Patrick Jinks, leadership and strategy coach and president of the Jinks Perspective. Happy almost mid-December. Happy almost end of 2020. Hang in there, folks. There is life ahead. There's life here now, actually. I'm talking to so many people that have made 2020 just extraordinary through all this. It's kind of amazing. We're about to talk to one of them today. I'm really excited about this episode. An old friend and colleague and partner, Liz Nilsson, is on the program today. She is currently the associate director of the Agile Strategy Lab at the University of North Alabama. And this started back when she was at the Agile Strategy Lab at Purdue University. So she's kind of shifted roles and locations there. She just has a passion for creating programs that nurture the next generation of thinkers and doers, particularly, and this is her bent and specialty, particularly through the development and growth of innovation and STEM education ecosystems. I think most of the listeners of this podcast know what STEM is, but it's an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math. And it's just been her wheelhouse for a long time now. Liz teaches. She is a practitioner. Lots of online stuff. We'll talk about what's available online if you want to get more resource from Liz. But she does a lot of this in person as well. Shepherds the expansion of the lab's programming. She oversees partnerships with other organizations interested in deploying what we're going to be centering our conversation on today, and that is a concept called strategic doing. She's one of the co-authors of the book, Strategic Doing, 10 Skills for Agile Leadership. It's a Wiley book published last year. She co-authored it with Edward Morrison, Scott Hutchison, Janice Fadden, and Nancy Franklin. And it is so, so cool. Liz is a former program officer at VentureWell. She's led STEM initiatives at the Penn State Center at Pittsburgh. She's been at the Institute for Advanced Learning and Research in Virginia, tied to Virginia Tech. This is where I met Liz. We were doing some work with United Way and some other things that we were focused on. So I'm really excited about that. And by the way, if you hear a baby crying in the background, that's my grandson. He's here this week. So that'll be fun. See there? There it is. I should make that a part of the podcast. By the way, we're learning a lot about leadership with a grandson. So anyway, with no further ado, the last thing I want to say about Liz is how much of a friend she is, how much of a respected colleague she is, and I always love connecting with her. I think the last time, Liz, we connected, we had dinner one night or lunch or something up in, where was that? I don't even remember where that was. Were you up in DC area? Was that where we connected?
Fredericksburg, maybe?
Yeah, maybe something like that. Maybe, anyway,
yeah.
Liz
yeah,
is all
Mexican dinner.
Liz is all over the place. And by the way, check out her TED talk as well. Her TEDx talk is about the superpower of the question mark, which is super amazing. We'll talk a little bit more about Liz. This is so awesome. Thanks for coming on the show. Welcome.
I'm really excited to talk to you again.
Yeah,
thanks.
Me too. Always. I think we need to catch up more, but this is a good opportunity to do so. I want to dig right into content because it's just super, super rich. We're obviously going to talk about the book, Strategic Doing, but Strategic Doing is more than a book, right? It's a framework for doing. I was on a call this morning with a group of new executive directors of nonprofits. And they were asking questions about the difference between strategic planning and business planning and, you know, how is it all related? Your book is Strategic Doing, which is about that signifies the action, the actual execution of strategy. But when you read the book, it's funny how it's not until skill 7 of 10 skills that you say start. The first six steps are about the thinking and the framing and the connecting and the identifying and the planning. And then skill seven, and I don't want to jump ahead too much, but I'm setting this up to say it is a framework, but you don't actually start the execution right away. And that's where everybody seems to want to dive in. Let's go. So tell us a little bit first about you and your background, anything I may have missed in your introduction, kind of what led you to this point. And then let's start talking about the concept of the book, where it came from.
Sure. So my background is in nonprofit program management. Here's sort of the trajectory of my career. So I started out working for a number of nonprofit organizations, and some of those were terrific experiences, and some of those were just really frustrating and awful experiences.
Wait a minute. Experiences in the nonprofit sector?
Yeah, what? I had a few of those. Yeah. And I got really interested in, well, why do some of these places seem great and others of them seem like things are just kind of a mess? And I got really interested in that. And a consultant that one of the organizations was working with said, well, if you're really interested in that question, you should go to graduate school and get an MBA and focus on organizational development. So I did that, and that I got a lot of insight into why it was that organizations either succeed or fail to thrive. I got a lot of great information about that and new ways to look at that, and that was terrific. But then in my next job in a nonprofit organization, one of the things that I was doing was, and this was true of a couple of organizations I was with, I was part of collaborations among different organizations, which obviously in the nonprofit world is where a lot of things happen. And what I found was that while I had learned a lot about individual organizations and how to make them thrive, I had learned almost nothing about, well, how do you get these people to collaborate when there's no one that can tell them what to do? That is increasingly where most of our work is, as people in the social sector. And so that was frustrating. And it wasn't until I met my now colleague, Ed Morrison, who's the person who developed Strategic Doing, that the light bulb kind of went on, like, oh, this is how you can get people to do work together, even though there's no hierarchy to kind of force them into that.
That's a really good, I hadn't thought about that framework of no hierarchy. I think it also is, you and I are both fans of the adaptive leadership concept and the idea of when there are no known answers and you're in the space of co-creating work together and even getting at what is even the problem? What are the questions we should be asking ourselves? And then how together can we find answers that work? When there's no known hierarchy, but no known solution to what we're trying to do, particularly, I mean, that's the whole point of innovation is that nobody's done it before, you're in new territory. So it's kind of a lack of a hierarchy as well as a lack of a technical one answer solution to things. Am I right?
Yeah, we talk about that a lot. And sometimes people will say, strategic doing help me? Or help us. And part of the thing we ask them is, well, what kind of problem is it that you're working on? And if you're working on a problem that's a technical problem where you kind of already have the knowledge and the skills, or you know who does in your network, then that's not really the place for strategic doing, because that's really just a question of implementation. Mm-hmm. But if you're working on something that's an adaptive challenge, when often the problem itself is pretty fuzzy, and for sure the answer is fuzzy, that's where what we do makes a lot more sense.
Okay. So walk us through, like, at the highest level, what is strategic doing? What is it? What's the framework?
Yeah. So strategic doing is an approach to thinking and implementing strategy that's designed for open, loosely connected networks. And we can talk about what that is, that helps collaborations form quickly, helps them focus on strategic outcomes, and helps them get moving immediately, with the understanding that because it's an adaptive challenge, they're going to learn as they go and adjust, that there's no way they can kind of plan it all out. You can't sort of think your way through this issue. You're going to have to do your way through the issue.
So is the planning component incorporated into the framework? It's strategic doing, not strategic planning, but is the planning framework integrated into it? Or is that something people have to have done first before they move into a strategic doing framework?
They can do either. We do a fair amount of work with people who have already done a strategic plan, and what they're stuck on is implementation, and they want help with that. And we can help them figure out how to do that. We work with other groups that say, you know, we have done so many strategic plans, we are just sick of it. Can you help us think about doing it differently?
Okay. So let's go ahead and talk about that term you said a minute ago. The book is and the framework are designed specifically for open, loosely connected networks. What does that mean? Maybe give us an example or two. And why design for them? Why not a niche organization like a soup kitchen? You know, why? So what is an open, loosely connected network, and why is it designed specifically for them?
So an open, loosely connected network is a network of people that are in some sense voluntarily there. I mean, there's more voluntary and less voluntary for sure. You know, we're all in meetings that we've been told we need to be part of, right? But that in some sense, people are not there because they have to, because their place in a hierarchical organization says they have to be. But in some sense, they're there because they want to be there. And so they're loosely connected in that sense. And it's open because there's a sense in which people can kind of come in and come out. You know, maybe their interest in whatever it is changes. Maybe they're, particularly when it's a collaboration of different organizations, maybe their organization's priorities change and it doesn't make sense for them to be part of that collaboration anymore. But they're voluntary and there's their dynamic that they're changing over time.
Okay. That's a little bit also of the lack of hierarchy sort of piece of it. Mm-hmm. How is that? I'm hearing a little bit of a distinction, and maybe I'm reading something into it that's not there, but I'm hearing a little bit of a distinction between this framework and the collective impact framework. And again, you and I have looked at that, the Kanye and Kramer out of the, you know, several years ago, where collective impact, the framework of setting a common agenda and having a backbone organization and agreeing on the metrics and working on something together or collectively. But in that framework, it does seem a little more formal and structured, and that it's not as open. But maybe I don't mean to criticize it. I'm just, I hear that. That sounds
it's a really good
different.
Question.
That sounds a little different than what you're talking about. How would you maybe compare them, the commonalities and the differences?
So I would say there's a lot of overlap. And in general, people say about strategic doing, they'll say, well, that sounds a lot like X. And usually the answer is yes, there's a lot of overlap. I think the primary place where strategic doing is different than collective impact, and I have to say I'm not a collective impact expert, mm-hmm. is the idea of that backbone organization, that strategic doing works even if there's no backbone organization, okay. because what it really focuses on is distributed leadership. Mm-hmm. And so that the teams can be self-directed with distributed leadership even when there's not a backbone organization, at least to a certain scale. I mean, there is a point at which, you know, if initiative becomes really big with lots of resources to manage, you do, in most cases, have to have some organization that steps up and says, you know, well, at least on an administrative level, we'll be the people that keep that part going.
Yeah, that makes sense. So one or two more questions before we get into the content of the book, because I'm hoping you can walk us through the key tenets. There's 10 skills for agile leadership is the subtitle of the book. And so we want to talk about what agile leadership is first. And maybe you can do that while you tell us about what the Agile Strategy Lab is and what you do.
So the Agile Strategy Lab is itself a network of folks. So some of us are, get our paychecks from the same place, but we have a lot of partners that we work with as well. And our mission is to help individuals and groups apply the principles of Agile in an organizational strategy context. So often when people hear the word Agile, they think either software development or sometimes manufacturing, particularly if they're kind of lean people. And what we're talking about is how do you take those ideas and translate them into a context that has nothing to do with software or widgets, but has to do with, you know, how it is that we are going to do work together.
Okay. And I'm just, you know, words mean things, and just the term agile, I mean, it means something. We build these, I'm in an organizational development program at Columbia International University, and in its PhD program in organizational leadership. And it is a faith-based university. And one of the tenets we were talking about recently in strategic planning was the story of Moses and how, you know, what strategic planning elements or concepts or components did Moses use in his life, you know, bringing the people of Israel out of Pharaoh's command and taking them to the promised land and the 10 commandments and the whole thing. And it's funny because I commented in one of our discussions that we tell our clients in my business that your strategic plan is not something, it should be flexible and adaptable. You know, it's not written in stone. And so they were asking us about comparing that to Moses. Well, Moses was literally written in stone, right? The Ten Commandments, like literally. How do you compare strategic planning with someone whose plan is sort of given to them in stone? Like there's no negotiating this. There's no flexibility. There's no agility to this whatsoever. So when I think of the word agile, I think of how, if 2020 hasn't taught us the need for agility.
No kidding. Yes.
Nothing has. Yes. Okay. So, I'm going to let you kind of go through at your own pace. I'd love for you to introduce, the concepts of the skills of strategic doing and just kind of walk us through the 10 steps or the 10 skills.
Sure. Let me start off by explaining the title of the book, because that probably puts it in context.
Good.
So we intentionally chose the phrase agile leadership because we really believe that the 10 skills are usable by anyone, no matter what level they're at in an organization. So they might be a summer intern or they might be a CEO. It doesn't matter.
Oh, that's very helpful. Those skills are positional. Useful. Good.
So there is a way in which we use the skills put together into a process with teams, but our book kind of stops short of that. It's really written for individuals that are looking at how do I become a more agile leader and have more effective conversations and collaborations. So just to kind of put that in context.
Yep, that's helpful.
So the 10 skills are things that we have over time identified as really the keys to good collaborations. It's interesting. So Ed Morrison, who's our director, is the one that developed strategic doing, and it really is an emergent practice. You know, it's something that started out with, he identified four questions, and then those four questions have become the 10 skills. And the four questions are, you know, what could we do? What should we do? What will we do? And then when are we going to get back together to kind of adjust as we need to? So, but those have sort of morphed into 10 skills. And if you look closely, you can kind of see how those 10 kind of line up with those four.
And that's important. I mentioned this call that I was on this morning. I know you share this. I'm a big believer in starting with the right questions. Mm-hmm. And so people say, well, is this a strategy or is this a tactic? Or are we doing operational planning? I'm like, I don't care what you call it. You can call it anything you want. Here's what's important. Do you know what you're doing? Do you know why you're doing it? Do you know where you want to go? Do you know where you stand today in terms of that? Do you know, like, just ask, this really isn't rocket science, which by the way, is one of the things I love about the book. It is not like this high academic, you know, framework of theory. It is based in research, but it's simple to read and understand. We've got to simplify this stuff. In fact, I think that's one of the things, the concepts of the book is the how complex our world is. This is a way of really simplifying that. So I appreciate the fact those four questions are important to start with, because again, it keeps us from just starting to dive into answers. We might be answering the wrong questions. We haven't even thought about, wait a minute, what do we got to be asking ourselves here? I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So the first two skills have to do with before you have a conversation often. So the first one is that if you're really working on an adaptive challenge, you need to create a space, and that might be physical or otherwise these days, in which people can have deep, focused conversations. So people need to feel psychologically safe. Sometimes they need to feel physically safe. Sometimes you need, you know, ground rules for how the conversation will go. But in some way, you need to make sure that people are in a place where they can have deep conversations, particularly with adaptive challenges. So that's the first one. The second one is this idea of the appreciative question, that we need to frame our conversation with a question that points us towards opportunities rather than problems. You know, we have a lot of bad habits that most of us have picked up in our professional lives. And one of them is that we tend to focus on problems. You know, that's why we call a meeting. We say, we need to have a meeting because we have this problem.
That's right.
You know, it just is the way we work. And, but if you're really working on adaptive challenge and you don't want to get sucked down into the, you know, let's complain, let's spend what could be years and years and years crunching data to understand why something's a problem, that the way to kind of get out of that morass is to frame your conversations with an appreciative question that points people to opportunities. So those two things can happen just, you know, you sitting at your desk and thinking about this conversation you're going to have with a person, right?
That's similar to the Heath Brothers book, Switch, where they talk about the bright spots, you know, where instead of going into a problem and saying, well, just what you said, and getting at the data around the problem and why is the problem what it is, that let's find where it is working and replicate that. And focus on the bright spot. Sounds like a similar concept there. I love it. And that's the idea behind appreciative inquiry. I will say this though, Liz, there's a, I know you're familiar. I think you're familiar with Warren Berger, his book, A More Beautiful Question. He talks about a 3-question step to innovation that does start with why.
Yeah.
And the why sometimes is why do we always do it this way? Or why is it that I can't, you know, a lot of innovation and problem solving has started with, why does this do this? I remember our son, Clayton, who turns 30 this week, when he was, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old, he was going, why doesn't this toy light up? They ought to make this light up. And that's the beginning of innovation. But the key though, is that in Warren Berger's work, you move pretty quickly to the next question, which is what if?
Right.
You know, okay, exactly. what if we could put a battery in the bottom of it? Or what if we could make it, you know, and then the final question is how or how might we?
Right.
Exactly. So he does start with that, maybe the negativity to get at the problem. That's a sales 101 thing, right? What problem are you solving? But he pretty quickly, you got to move into the what if. And that's where I think a lot of organizations fall short. Is that your experience?
I think so. And I think in most cases, the group they've already spent enough time talking about the problem.
Okay.
That's they true. Know enough about the why to get moving. You know, I mean, it's rare that the group hasn't ever talked about the problem. And I think usually they've talked enough. That's not to say that there isn't more to learn, but they've talked enough to get moving.
That's awesome.
So that's 1 and 2. So then the next thing the next skills we identify have to do with, the idea that you work with the assets you already have. You know, the other thing that we spend a lot of time in meetings doing is talking about, well, if only we had X, you know, if only we had more resources, if only we had this facility, if only we had new staff, if only we spend a lot of time in that space. And so part of what we say is you've actually already got enough. It's hard to believe, but you actually do have enough, at least to get started. So identify what the assets are that you have that you can work with. And in a network, often, you know, you bring a group of people together who maybe haven't done a lot of work together, or even if they haven't had this kind of conversation, the people have all kinds of resources that they've never said, well, I have this skill. Oh, well, I have access to this space. Oh, I have, you know, I'm connected with this network of people who might be able to help us. And so having that conversation about, well, what do we have? Let's put it all on the table. So that's the third one. And the fourth one then is, how could you connect those things in new and different ways to create value? I have to say that one of the things we like to say about the 10 is that nobody's good at all 10. And this is one that's particularly challenging for me. It just is. It's just not the way my brain works. Fortunately, I work with some people who are really good at it. And you know, so to me, it's like magic. You know, people will sort of say, here's all the resources I've got. And then one of my colleagues will say, well, if I put this with this with this, then this magic thing happens. And I think, how did you do that? But that's really where some magic happens, when you can put together things that haven't been put together before.
Well, and that is, I don't even know where to start on that one. Let me pause, because I've got questions I might ask you a little bit later about that particular concept. Keep going through the skills.
That's the third and the fourth skills. The fifth one is one that for many groups is kind of counterintuitive, and that is to find what we call the big easy. Find the opportunity that both will have impact, but is doable. Some people, their sort of natural inclination is to, let's find the thing that's going to make the most impact. The problem is that you might get stuck because it's really hard. And if you get stuck, then people get discouraged and they kind of drop away. So you need something that is going to keep people engaged because it's doable, but it has to be have enough impact that it's important enough for people to spend their time on.
So we talk about early successes a lot. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about, right? Find something that can get the thing off dead center, because momentum, success breeds success.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's number five. And then number six is to take that idea, because it's not necessarily a project. Often it's an idea. And to start to get some real clarity about what that is. And the way we ask people to get clarity about that is to talk about what would success look like? Because often, even if you have an idea and you've agreed that it's going to have impact and be doable, you still actually, if you could look inside people's brains, they have very different ideas of what that idea is. And you need to fix that right then before you get any further, right? So if you can talk about what success looks like, then you can make sure everybody's kind of got the same picture in their brain.
And your skill says in the book, the way it's worded is to convert the ideas into measurable outcomes. So when you say, what does success look like? The next question is, what will indicate to you that you're there? And this might be, out of all 10 skills, the one that like lights me up and gets my attention is this measurability. And part of it is because I spent so much time focused with our clients and when I was in organizational leadership on the metrics and what we're measuring, and particularly now work I'm doing around mission metrics. We have these mm-hmm. grand missions as organization, right? Make our community a better place to live. Oh, that's great. That's a novel, noble thought. What does that mean? What are the metrics? How are you measuring against your mission? We have financial metrics. We have even program outcome level metrics sometimes.
Sure.
But that mission metric of, you know, we want to, you know, provide opportunity for youth to reach their potential. That's great. But what does that, how do you measure that?
Mean.
Mm-hmm. What are your indicators for that?
Yeah. So, well, we actually, and this might be hard for someone like you, we actually ask people to not think of this as an evaluation plan.
Right. Right. But it is a magnetic north though, right?
It is, but we ask people to sort of take off what they think of as limitations to this process. So for example, we want our organization, we want to better serve our community, mm-hmm. which again is one that, you know, many organizations have. But if you have a conversation about, well, what would that look like? Maybe people would say, people from other communities would come to see what we do. Mm-hmm. That's how we would know it's successful.
Right.
And then, well, how would we measure that? Well, we could do a survey of everyone in our community and ask them how many people they've told about us. Now, you would never actually do that. But if you can all agree that that would be the right outcome, then you can make sure you're seeing the same thing. So we encourage people to not think about, well, is that a doable metric? It actually doesn't matter at this point. You may come back mm-hmm. and say, now let's come up with some doable metrics. Mm-hmm. But at this point in the process, all you're trying to do is make sure that people are seeing the same thing. So kind of take off your, oh my gosh, that would be a $2 million metric. It doesn't matter. It's okay for this part of the conversation. It's okay.
Okay. That's good. No, I like that. It is a little, you're not saying that the metrics don't matter. You're saying that where they fall in the process does. Right. So right now,
they're means to an end. Right now they're a means to an end.
Right. Okay, good.
Oh yeah.
Got it.
But again, it's not for people who spend their life in evaluation plans, and you do, and I do, right? This one can be a little bit hard because you think, I can't put that in my grant proposal. It's okay. It doesn't need to go in your grant proposal.
Yeah. Okay, good.
So those are the first six. And then, as you said, with number seven, you move into action.
Yeah.
So number seven is to find a starting project. Find something you can start doing immediately that you don't need permission for, that you've already got the resources, that's going to help you test whether or not something is really easy and is going to have impact. So find something you can do. We'd like to say, find something that's going to take you a couple months max. Because again, you want to have something that people are going to be excited about having gotten done, but it's still going to have some impact. So that's number seven.
Yeah. And again, I like the words in the book, start slowly to go fast, but start.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, often these study projects are really tiny.
Yeah.
Often they're just super tiny. And I can give you some examples later if you want, but you know, we've seen some amazing, initiatives start with something that just seems so small.
Right. But they get you moving, you know, you're not, yeah. People like me get frustrated where it's just plan, concept, framework, write it out on paper. This is great. Brand it. And you never actually get into the action. So you do have to start somewhere, and identifying that starting point is key. So I love it. Start slowly to go fast, but start.
And you know, part of the nature of an adaptive challenge is probably the group you have in the room isn't big enough to really take it on. Mm-hmm. So that start, one of the functions of a starting project is to get other people interested because you're going to need them, right?
Excellent.
So that's number seven. Number eight is really critical. And this is where an awful lot of meetings go off the rails, is to, before you walk out of the room, every single person should have something to do that's concrete with a deadline and a deliverable. Every single person. So one of our rules is there are no observers in strategic doing. No one can say, I'm sorry, I'm just too busy, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Or so I thought so-and-so was doing it, or yeah.
Right. You know, so making sure that everybody takes responsibility for something, and it should be a pretty small something. You know, we like to say, you know, people should pick something that are going to take them no more than 1 hour a month, which doesn't seem like very much. But the thing is, for most leaders, most people listening to this, I'm guessing, are the people who in school always got caught doing all the work for their groups. Oh. They got a group project, right? They're the, right, me too, right? Yeah, like, I don't want to be a part of this group because I'm going to end up getting stuck with all the work. But if everybody takes something to do, you can actually get a lot done. And nobody disappears from the group because they're afraid they're going to get stuck with it, right?
We could spend an entire episode talking about that leadership dynamic. Because I'm thinking of all the reasons why that doesn't happen. Sometimes somebody wants to dominate and get all the glory and the credit and just do the stuff. Yeah. Sometimes it's just they would like to distribute the leadership, but they don't trust the people around them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they trust the people around them at first, but then the people around them disappoint. And so, yeah, fool me once, you know, there are lots of reasons that happens. And so, I don't know if you want to talk about that anymore, if there are any sort of tips or experience that you have to help people get to that place of trust. And I mean, you got to have competence to do these things, you know, the people taking on these assignments, and you got to follow through and you have to have trust. But I think you're right. This number eight here is a place where a lot breaks down. If you're careful.
I think part of it is if have you picked the right small thing to take on? Because part of what that helps you do is figure out which of these people can I really trust? Who's really going to get it done?
Yeah.
You kind of managed your risk in that way, that you're not trying to, as my colleague Ed says, you're not trying to boil the ocean. We're trying to get this little thing done. And part of what that little thing helps us sort out is which of these people can I really count on? Mm-hmm. You know, who's really got skills and can count on it. And, you know, our experience is that if people commit to something and don't do something, that they might come to a second meeting. They might come to a third. After that, they take themselves out usually because they're embarrassed. Because that's number nine is you come back together at a regular intervals and you talk about what did you learn when you each did your action steps. Mm-hmm. And you do not sugarcoat the fact. If someone didn't do their thing, you don't sugarcoat it. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be mean, but you say, oh, that didn't get done.
Yeah. Yeah. And we said it out loud and we all recognize that.
Yes.
So that's the accountability check.
Yeah.
Now in the framework, you call this 30-30 meetings. Explain that.
Yeah. So 30-30 is kind of our default style for doing this, which is we get together usually every 30 days and we talk about, excuse me, we talk about what did we learn as we did this thing that we committed to do. Not so much a blow by blow of then I talked to that person, you know, but kind of the, what did I learn from the past 30 days? And then what are we going to do for the next 30 days? Everybody commits to something else to do for the next 30 days. But depending on the project, you know, we have our staff meeting has become a 7-7 meeting. So rather than a weekly staff meeting, we have a 7-7 team meeting. We know groups that do every 2 weeks. We know groups that particularly like national collaborations that'll do, you know, every 60 or 90 days. Because it just, you know, 30-30 doesn't make so much sense.
Mm-hmm. Good.
It can be whatever. So that's number nine. Mm-hmm. And then number 10 is that these are really about habits. And habits have to be, we've all tried, we're coming up on January, New Year's resolutions, we know how that usually goes, right? Habits have to be reinforced. And so the way we encourage people to sort of reinforce new ways of working together is that you have to nudge each other to do what you said you would do. You have to connect new people to the effort. And you have to promote, you have to talk about the success that you're having. Mm. So that's number 10.
That's good. These are great. And I know you blew this through these quickly. I definitely want to encourage our listeners to get this book. It is really powerful. And the really good thing about the book that I like, this is what I like about books and Switch that I mentioned a minute ago does this well too, is the case studies that are included in the book that show you how these work. Could you share maybe one or two places where you've seen this really framed out well and led to something meaningful?
Sure. So I'll tell the story in the context of that starting project can be very small. So I came to Strategic Doing. I was part of a national organization that had a project with undergraduate engineering universities, programs in universities. And the idea was that they wanted engineering students to have an experience with entrepreneurship and innovation before they graduated. That was kind of the big picture goal. And I worked with teams from 50 universities on that. One of the teams that we worked with was the University of Puerto Rico, which is a place where, talk about a place that it's easy to think they don't have very many resources. You know, I mean, besides the fact that they just don't have any resources just because of that's the way it is. Then, you know, every couple of years a hurricane comes through or an earthquake or whatever, you know? So it's easy to think that they don't have that many resources. And their team identified that what they wanted to do was to bring business students and engineering students together and give them opportunities to think about, well, you know, maybe we could do a startup. You know, maybe there's a technology problem that we think we could solve with a new business. Because in Puerto Rico, the big challenge is that they graduate all these great students and then those students move to Florida. And so, you know, the big picture of the economy of the island is they need to start building a place where startups can flourish. So that was sort of, let's bring engineering students and business students together. And so let's design a course that they do together when they're seniors to start new startups. Those of the people who are listening to your podcast who work in universities are thinking to themselves, oh yeah, faculty senate, the provost has to sign off. You know, there's department chairs that don't want this to happen. I mean, there's a lot of just inertia in a university that keeps good ideas from happening. And that's true. So what was key was they're picking the right starting project. And their right starting project was, they said, well, we can't do a whole course. We don't think we can even actually really pilot a course yet. Even that is too big. There's too many people that would kind of say, well, why do you want to do that? Whatever. But what they could do, and this was amazing to me that they could do this. They had the right assets. They had someone from the business department. They had someone from the engineering department. And they also, we talk about kind of what social assets do you have? They had somebody who knew the registrar. And so someone went to the registrar and said, we're both offering senior classes next year. Could you schedule those at the same time in rooms right next to each other? And the registrar said, I guess I could do that. And they said, great. So what happened was, without ever having to tell anyone they're doing a pilot, the engineering teacher and the business teacher could get together and plan things for those students to do together. It was so tiny, so tiny. But what they have now is that university has a very thriving startup scene. And the project lead for that project is now the vice president for the system for the University of Puerto Rico.
Wow.
It's become this enormous initiative that's bringing in millions of dollars. But they started with, could you put these two courses in classrooms next to each other? That was it.
That's great. Well, that's a perfect example of start slow to go fast, but start.
And use what you've got.
Yeah. Oh,
they
yeah.
They could have said, oh, we need $1 million. Oh, we need the Senate to tell us we're allowed to do this. No, you don't need that.
Right. So that's what I was, a while ago, I paused to just kind of let you go on through the skills, but this portion on resources, I think is really important for our, particularly our social sector leaders that are listeners to this podcast and practitioners. And that is, and we've lamented this many times, the fact that so many in the sector have a scarcity mentality. And it's, you know, we always need. And every, you know, strategic planning process we go, not everyone, but most of the strategic planning processes we go through with clients, it's all about, well, it, like you said, if only. And it's always if we only have more money, because everything comes down to money. Because, yes, if only we have more technology and staff and blah, but that costs money. So it always comes down to money. And I think you're so right about you have the resources. We don't realize that we often misuse the resources we have. We have them misappropriated. Intentional, good intentions, but, you know, to Jim Collins' good to great concept of the right people on the right bus and the right positions and all that, we have people that have talents that we're not using. They're in the wrong position, the wrong role. We have money that we're spending where we shouldn't be spending it, that we could use on something else. We are loath to change our budgets in a transformational way that says, you know, this is where we're headed. And when you were talking about that, so one is I thought about, we've got to get more of an abundance mentality. And you know, abundance might be a word that many nonprofits go, well, that's fun for you to say, but we don't have abundance, right? But you do have resources. How are you using them is question one. The other thing is I always think about the Apollo 13 story. And particularly in the movie, which is very factual and it's not a documentary, it's a docudrama really, but it's pretty accurate. And one of the things in one of the main ideas of the movie is that in order to survive the trip back home after their ship got messed up is that they had to create a filter to filter out the carbon dioxide that was going to kill them if they didn't do it. Well, they didn't have a filter for that because they didn't plan for that particular, very specific fluke emergency. So one of the questions that the flight director, Gene Kranz, asks is, what do we have on the ship that's good? That was his question. What do we have on the ship that's good? And they figured out, they brought this group of engineers together and said, we don't say we don't have a filter. With the resources we have on the ship, what can we do? And they built a filter from the materials that they had. And then they told the astronauts how to, you know, here's what you have on the ship. Here's what you need to do. Put this duct tape around this and put this piece of cellophane over here. And, you know, they this was the literal example of having to put a square peg into a round hole. They had to build this filter. And I love that question. What do we have on the ship that's good? I wish more organizations would ask that. What do we have in this organization that's meaningful, that's productive, that's valuable, that's good? And maybe we just need to use it differently.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, we show that clip from the movie often in our in-person trainings because it's such a great illustration of that idea. And I would also say that sometimes you have things that you don't even know you have.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to say right now is a business example, but I think it is just as relevant to the social sector. Mm-hmm. So we worked with an organization, it was a business that had been told they had always been a cost center. It was an IT group. They'd always been told they're a cost center. And now all of a sudden they needed to become a revenue center. And so when they had this conversation about what do we have, there was one person in the IT group who said, well, I don't know if this is relevant at all, but I have this hobby. I've been kind of playing around with illustration and animation programs. It's not part of my job. It's just what I do when I go home because I'm kind of a geek. That asset, that resource that they had, they built an entire business around within the organization offering simulation and animation services. But it was something that they didn't even know they had until they asked the question, what do we have? And often the most valuable resources are things that are not, they're things that people are not using in their everyday professional life. They're things that they have because they're hobbies or somebody they know. You know, nobody's ever asked them that question.
Okay, help me with this. I'm going to play devil's advocate on that one.
Yeah.
In a business, the real mission is to make money.
Yeah.
So in a nonprofit, the real mission is some social objective in a community. How do you do what you're talking about without mission drift? So yeah, I've got this animation skill. Well, that's great. How's that going to advance the mission? So how would you advise a nonprofit to make sure that their innovative framing of the resources they have are still always directed somehow at the mission?
I think that's what the appreciative question is for. Mm. You know, that the question is, well, how does that, sometimes you don't know exactly how it's going to connect, but you have to at least have a sort of a plausible
explore
case. How it might. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking back to where you challenged me a minute ago about the metrics. I'm sensing that this is a case of don't worry about that just right away. Don't let that stop you, right? Because I'm throwing up, like I said, devil's advocate, right? But these are the barriers we put on ourselves.
Yeah. And this is why I'm not so good at that. How do we put things together? Because I'm doing what you're doing. Like, oh, I don't know. Is that a good idea or not? I'm not sure. Does it fit?
Yeah.
It's really kind of a brainstorming exercise. And it takes the people who are willing to say, let's put A and B and X together and just, you know, let's put that down there as an idea, you know, but I tend to kind of put it in the filter of, gosh, does that really fit in with our, you know, mission and our, you know, we have these, you know, organizational goals that we adopted last year and does it exactly fit in there, you know, but sometimes the best ideas come from at least for a period of time in a conversation, thinking outside the box.
It absolutely does. I don't think we do enough idea creation. We don't pause to make idea creation an intentional step. And that is one thing back to the, this isn't the collective impact model so much, but I think you're familiar with Richard Harwood and the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation did a lot of work with United Ways around these community conversations and mobilization. And one of the tenets in his pathway is to create innovation space. Like you have, there has to be this intentionality around innovation, not just it's serendipitous. Someone happened to come up with something, but there's actually a space and an intentionality around ideating.
Yes.
And this framework.
Skill.
Yeah. And this framework does that. I also love what you said about, no one has all 10 skills. This is certainly a leadership concept that resonated with me when you said that is in leadership, we have to surround ourselves with the right people. Let's talk organizational leadership for a minute. We have to fill in our own gaps. And to do that, we have to recognize our own deficiencies. So we don't, as a CEO, you know, maybe you're real dynamic and visionary and you're great out in the, you know, but you're not great with, the process side of things, or maybe you're great at marketing, but not numbers. And you've got to surround yourself with people that can do those things. And again, in order to get that trust, it starts with competence. So you have to surround yourself with the people that fill in your gaps. I that resonated with me a little while ago about not all people don't have all 10 skills.
Yeah. And left to our own devices, most of us will hire people like ourselves. We just do.
That's true.
Right?
I'm laughing
because we really have to work against that.
I know.
That's like you have experience with that.
I do. That was my sigh. I'm like, oh, she got, that's an indictment on me. Yeah. It's so true. It's so true. So what would be, Liz, maybe two or three of the, if we're talking about leadership here, and that's what this podcast is about. This is a framework for collaboration and for strategic thinking and for planning and moving and executing. What are, if there were like two or three key leadership tenets in this, What are the primary leadership concepts required in this process, particularly when, again, it's adaptive, the hierarchy's not there, it's open, it's loose? What's leadership look like? How do you keep the whole machine working?
So I think one thing is that but in the way that we ask teams to work together, leaders have to be willing to be open to new possibilities. And some leaders are more able to do that than others. But in that ideating, that diplomatic creative space, there may be things that come out that are like, that's not exactly what I would have picked. Uh-huh. And, you know, so leaders have to have a little bit of a, give their teams a little bit of space to think differently. And that is just, it's easier for some people than others. But if you know that you're a person that is, you just have to have control, this probably is not the podcast episode to listen to.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
That's one thing, I think. And then the other thing, and this is sort of the flip side of that, I guess, is that this is really about distributed leadership. That one of our just kind of baseline convictions is that the era of the, you know, single leader who gets it all done, who should get all the credit, is, if it was ever true, it's over now. Mm-hmm. And to deal with these really, what we sometimes call wicked problems, is going to take a really different approach. And it means that everybody needs to be a leader. And if we're the positional leader, the CEO or whatever, we need to be thinking about, how do I develop my other people to be leaders, because I'm going to need us all to take on this challenge.
We're hearing that from so many of the people that come on this show. That has been a theme. Leaders, you know, the difference between a high individual performer and a high impact leader, where leadership is the work, mm-hmm. not I'm really good at this particular skill or technical aptitude or whatever, but my job is leadership and what that takes. And Liz, you have, I've watched you lead. You're a practitioner of this and have been very effective. And I would love to ask you, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions as we wrap this that I ask all of my guests. And the first one is, who would you point to in your early life or career that you would say have helped sort of mold and shape your perspective and view on leadership? Who were those early leaders in your life that kind of, that's kind of what led me down this road of how I think about leadership and what I believe about it?
So I think the person I would point to is, and I've been thinking about this person a lot lately because they're a character in they're a real person, but they make an appearance in a book that I've been reading because they have, since I knew them, have become quite prominent. He was my very first boss at a real job. And he, you know, I had just finished my first year in college, and he gave me real responsibility. He trusted me to do a good job. It's not that he, you know, gave me responsibility and just let me go and never checked back in. He did. And if something wasn't quite right, he told me it wasn't quite right and asked me to fix it. He was an amazing leader to someone who saw herself just as the summer intern who didn't have very much to offer. And so I can see why now, when he's had the opportunity to lead very, very large organizations, he's been very effective, because people know that about him, that he personally cares about people. He wants to give them meaningful work to do. He'll hold you to high standards, but he is willing to let you do it. So, and that was tremendously important to me at a really critical time as a professional, I think.
So I have two questions about that. One, a while ago when you were talking about this happens, this strategic doing is practical for any level of leadership, you said including summer interns.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing you were truly thinking about yourself and your experience in that point. Is that fair?
Actually, no. But we've had conversations with a couple of organizations lately who have been in one of our strategic doing sessions, maybe have been to one of our trainings and have said, I would like our summer interns to know how to do this. Can you help us?
That's great. And
because we think it would help our interns get off the dime really fast.
Yeah. Well, it's ingrained in your bent though, based on what you just said, that this is someone who gave a summer intern an opportunity to lead. And then my second question is, are you going to tell us who this person is?
No.
Okay. Fair enough.
I'll tell you after we're off the air.
All right. Just checking. Fair enough. Just want to make sure it wasn't something you just forgot.
No.
But the concept is important. And Michael Bryant was on our program last week, and he talked about this, about the leaders who develop other leaders. And they do so, number one, by giving opportunity, but also space to fail, you know, room to make those mistakes. And when you're a summer intern, you got to have a lot of room to fail and learn. So that's really great.
One of the ends of this story, which I think is really important, is one of the things he gave me to do that I did, and he told me I did a good job on, he got a whole bunch of public flack for it, including an editorial in the newspaper. And he took the heat.
He took it.
He didn't throw me under the bus and say, oh, that was my summer intern.
Boy, that's leadership.
Yeah.
That is absolutely leadership. Pretty rare leadership, as I think about it. Pretty rare.
Yeah.
Okay, Liz, what is the Liz Nielsen number one leadership concept? The thing that you would say to all leaders, paramount, your sort of number one tenet of leadership, what would that be?
I think the thing that has changed my own life the most is this idea of the appreciative question. That I was always a glass half empty person. And learning how to turn that around has I've seen it change organizations, and I've seen it change my own kind of professional capacity.
Yeah. Well, and you've practiced it. And by the way, check out Liz's TEDx talk. Just go to YouTube, Liz Nielsen, NILSEN, TEDx. You'll find it. That's the superpower of the question mark. And you demonstrate a good bit of it in the TED talk, which I love. Liz, thanks so much for coming on the program. I want to put whatever resources we need to on the website. If someone wanted to reach out to you, learn more about the resources, you've got some training. You teach people how to do this.
We do.
And you do it online. You do it in person. I think you've developed a set of new online courses and things. Best way for people to reach out to you if they want to learn more about what you're offering.
So there's two websites, strategicdoing.net, and then there's agilestrategylab.org. And you can find me through both of those, and you can find a list of our upcoming trainings, which, yes, they used to all be in person, and COVID has given us the wonderful opportunity to to figure out how to do that online.
I know. Same here. We just launched an online course this year, and I launched this podcast this year.
Yeah.
And I would credit COVID for a lot of that. We got to make, as one of our previous guests said, creative pivoting. We have to learn how to creatively pivot and get the most and stop complaining and whining and going, if only we weren't in the middle of a pandemic, we could do something.
Yeah.
We're learning that we can. Yeah. Liz, thanks so much. What rich work. I appreciate it. I've loved watching your journey just go deeper and deeper and higher and higher, and I've learned a lot from you, and I appreciate our friendship, and I appreciate the work you do and the quality and just the expertise. You're just such a pro. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun to have a good conversation with you, Patrick.
Always. Well, that's what we do. All right, folks, get the book, check out the websites, look at the podcast page at jinxperspective.com for all the resources. And in the meantime, lead on.